both locally and beyond. Information online at their Main Street storefront in Narrowsburg or their office in the Narrowsburg Union. DamascusCitizens.org.
Radio Catskill is your source for fact-based news and information, whether that's local, national, or from around the world. And while the news of the year reveals deep divisions, it is possible to embrace diversity of thought and build friendships despite differences. This public radio station is uniquely positioned to bridge these divides, but we can't do it without your support. Be part of this good work. Make your year-end donation now at wjffradio.org.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. And this week, with the holidays right around the corner, we've got a last-minute gift guide and festive lessons from the most unique cooking school I've ever come across. The New Yorker's Helen Rosner and Lisa Kyung Gross from the League of Kitchens coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill. WJFF Jeffersonville, Radio Catskill.
I'm Donna Fellenberg on Catskill Character. Ever since I did a four-part series for Farm and Country on the plight of the monarch butterfly, I've been very interested in all pollinators and their role in the food chain. So I'm delighted today to welcome artist and beekeeper Charles Wilkin of Two Queens Honey to Catskill Character. You might have caught him this fall at the Honeybee Festival in Narrowsburg, which he helped to produce. But there is so much more about him to share. So let's not waste another minute. Here's my conversation with Charles Wilkin. Charles, I'm so happy you could come in today. Welcome to Catskill Character.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me.
I know you grew up in Grand Island, New York, which I have to confess, never heard of.
Yeah, most people don't.
But it's in Erie County, and it's in the middle of the Niagara River.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you tell me a little something about what it was like growing up there?
You know, it's a pork chop-shaped island in the middle of the Niagara River, and that's the river that goes over the falls. And it's tucked in between Buffalo, New York, and Ontario, Canada on the other side. So growing up, it was often fun to hang out with friends on the shore, and you could literally look across at Canada. It was half a mile with the river. And it was a great place to grow up because I would say it's more like a rural suburb of Buffalo, you know, very populated around the shore with people with big houses and boats and stuff. But I lived in the interior, and it was very, like, pastoral and sort of farmy. And my parents just had a small house with 2.5 acres, and my dad literally farmed about an acre of it. You know, we just had that sort of rural lifestyle, you know, and I really liked it. I was able to ride my bike everywhere. There were trails and paths in the woods, and we used to build forts in the trees.
Oh.
And we had a pond in our backyard, too, so...
Did you swim in that pond?
No, it was full of leeches and other weird things, but... We did float boats on it and stuff.
It sounds really nice.
Yeah, it was lovely.
So aside from being a beekeeper, you're mm-hmm. also an artist.
I am.
Did anyone recognize your talents and encourage you when you were in high school?
Well, I think it goes back farther than high school. As a kid, I was always drawing and doodling and doing things like that. And I honestly used to love my sister's fashion Barbie plates. I thought that was the best thing ever. But it was in fifth grade when I... won an award for a fire prevention week or something. I made some drawing about people.
Like a poster?
Yeah, like a poster. Like, you know, people on fire running out of a building or whatever. And I won an award. And I think that was the moment where my parents sort of realized that I did have some skill and I actually was kind of serious about it. I love to draw. I always did. Whenever there was a stressful situation or whatever, I was always like drawing things and, you know, trying to get my demons out by drawing.
Well, you did end up at the Columbus College of Art and Design.
Yeah.
But that wasn't your first choice, right?
No, I desperately wanted to move to New York. I, you know, growing up in Buffalo and Grand Island, like, I knew for myself personally, like, I just needed to leave. I just wanted to have more experiences in life than growing up there. And I just knew that big cities seemed exciting to me. And I had heard that all the really good schools were in New York. And so, you know, I think Pratt and Parsons were like two of my favorites that I wanted to go and look at. You know, but I came from a big family and I was the second one to go to college, you know, out of five. So my parents didn't have a lot of money and they sort of were frank about it. Like, we can't afford to send you there. Mm. But it, you know, it didn't discourage me. I ended up going to the Columbus College of Art and Design because I got a 2-year scholarship. So, you know, that really made a big difference for me.
Well, you did have a very successful graphic design company mm-hmm. in Ohio. When did you finally get to New York City?
Yeah, I had a design studio in Columbus, Ohio. I started in 1994. I lived there for a long time, but I ended up moving with my husband, Martin, to New York in 2001, 4 months before 9/11. So, you know, not great timing, but, you know, nobody knew what was about to happen. So, yeah, it took me a long time. I think the reason it took that long was two things. My business was going so incredibly well in Ohio. It just didn't seem like there was any reason to leave. And also, too, I met my husband, Martin, in 1996. And, you know, I just fell in love with him and decided, okay, well, he lives here. He doesn't want to move to New York. Okay, maybe I can wait a little bit longer. And, you know, he was going through school at the time, too. So it just seemed, with the success of the business and that, it just seemed like, okay, I can put my New York dreams on hold for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But then after he graduated, we just both decided to move to New York. Because
what did he go to school for?
He went for public relations.
Oh, yeah.
So he had been working as an intern at Victoria's Secret in the PR department. And, you know, his boss was like, Martin, just move to New York. Don't stay here. So it all sort of worked out in the end there that, you know, the both of us ended up in New York.
Mm-hmm. When you finally got to New York mm-hmm. City, did it fulfill all the dreams that you had had about it?
Yes and no. Initially, when we first moved there, I was scared. I was so scared because it was so big and it suddenly became, suddenly I was living there and I had no idea how the subway system worked and all these other things.
I still have a problem with the subway system.
And it was also like, why are there several stores? Why is there a fruit store and a vegetable store and a meat store? Why can't I just get it all? You know, I've been spoiled by Midwestern, you know, lifestyle mm-hmm. living in Ohio. And it was great at first. And then, as I mentioned, 9/11 happened 4 months after we were there. And it really took the wind out of this, out of our sails for obvious reasons. I mean, you know.
On many levels.
I mean, thankfully, we didn't know anybody that was, you know, impacted by that. But it just, it was really difficult. And, you know, Martin and I went back and forth. Some nights I would lay there crying in bed saying, let's just go back to Ohio. And he would say, no, you wanted to do this. Let's stay. And then he would say the same thing 2 days later. And I think, I don't know, the best thing to come out of moving to New York is I think it really tightened up and solidified our relationship. Like, we really had to come together and mm-hmm. make it work because it was totally a struggle. Some of my business dried up and the company he was working for, he got laid off and, you know, we just both were scrambling for freelance work, you know, and it was really, really hard for a long time.
Mm-hmm. You know, we should mention something about who you are because mm-hmm. you told me a story about what happened when you were in high school and your father got a job in Rochester, mm-hmm. and your parents were going to move to Rochester from yeah. Grand Island. And what did you say?
Well, I said, no way, because I was so focused on going to art school that I wasn't going to leave these amazing teachers that were helping me, you know, build a portfolio to get into school. So I just got a job at a local sign company, and I was making $18 an hour. And in one summer, I had enough for 6 months to pay for an apartment. And, you know, by the time the summer was over, my parents were getting ready to move. And I just said, no, I'm going to get an apartment. I went into apartment building complex and the woman said, no, you're 17. I said, I have 6 months in cash. She said,
money talks. Nobody walks.
It totally talks. And she said, well, if you can get your mom or dad to sign for it, then I'll say yes. So my mom said yes. And I 17, I had an apartment.
You see, that's what I mean. That really yeah. speaks to who we can see already at yeah. such an early age, who you were.
Yeah.
You're a very determined
thank you.
Person, and you know what you want to do. You know what you have to do to get there, and you're going to do it.
you know, that I've had lots of struggles in my life, as everybody does. But the thing is, I don't want to give up. You know, I don't see any reason to give up. And
wait a minute. I have a quote from you.
Okay. Let's hear.
You said when I spoke to you earlier, I don't like to give up. The path forward isn't always clear.
Yes. I it's taken me a long time to realize that that is true.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, being a creative person, you know, sometimes the experiences you have in your life, you know, they influence your work, but they also influence your life in a lot of ways. And, for a long time when I was younger, I was very focused on one or two things and I would just go right for it. And oftentimes I wasn't very skilled at understanding how to get past the roadblocks or understanding that these couple ugly things that I have to get through or difficult things are actually how you get to where you want to go. It took me a long time to get to that point of realizing that sometimes you just have to roll with it and not let the bad times get in the way.
And the idea of being resilient,
mm-hmm.
I think, is very important. It sounds like you had a lot of resilience.
Well, I would say that definitely comes from living during those times in New York. Like, we had no choice, and you have to do it. You have to do things you don't want to do, or eat a little less because you don't have any money for food. And I know that sounds really extreme, but it's just those kinds of things. New York was crazy, and things were not as planned. And so you just have to do what you can to get by.
You know, I think this would be a good time to take a short break, and then we'll come back and talk about bees.
Yes.
For the next episode of Jazz Night, we gather around the fire for a special listen to pianist George Burton's burning holiday record, The Yule Log. We'll hear some seasonal favorites and some deep, deep Christmas cuts. Seriously, tunes I've never heard of. That's next time on Jazz Night in America. I'm Christian McBride. Join me for Jazz Night in America, Sunday at 8, here on Radio Catskill.
What do you need for a great holiday? Food, family, friends, and festive music. The first few are up to you, but you can let us take care of that last part with a special holiday playlist of classic Christmas tunes and new favorites from artists like Andrew Bird, Los Lobos, Carole King, The Bird and the Bee, and lots, lots more. Join us for a holiday celebration from World Cafe.
Christmas Day at 2 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Catskill Character. My guest today is Charles Wilkin, who with his husband T. Martin Higgins owns and operates Two Queens Honey. In the first part of the show, Charles talked about his early life and how he eventually became a beekeeper after a mad go-go career as a graphic designer. In the next half of the show, Charles is going to talk more about the bees and their influence on him as a person. Let's get back to it.
I always like to say that the bees know the way, because it's true. You know, the bees inherently know what to do. They live their lives basically as a community, and their whole objective is to make the honey. But it goes beyond that. They just instinctually do it. They don't think twice about it. During the summertime, bees only live 6 weeks. So during that short period of time, they have different roles and jobs that they do. And so, you know, the minute a bee is hatched out of the cell, they turn right around and they clean it out. The first few weeks, they're like housekeeper, undertaker. And it's not until the last 2 weeks of their life that they become the highly skilled guard bees and the foraging bees, because it takes them that long to learn how to do it. They just go through their life, and these jobs just happen. They watch and learn from other bees, and then one day they just seamlessly move from one job to another. If you think about that, it's a lot like living our own lives. You know, we just kind of go through life and we have these experiences, and you keep moving forward.
Hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully. From my perspective, the way I say that is the bees know the way. And so when I think about all these struggles and things that have happened in my life, I've learned through the bees to just watch them and learn from them, in that you just have to follow the path that's been given to you and try and make the best of it, you know, because they don't ever think twice about it. When it's rainy out and they can't go forage, you know, they just keep doing what they're doing.
So they don't go out of the hive when it's raining?
No, they can't, because if their wings get wet, they can't fly. And if it's too below 50, they can't really fly either. So,
tell us about the different bees, because I know there's different bees that have different jobs.
Yeah. So there's the worker bee, which is a lady bee. And then there's the drones, which are the boy bees. And then there's the queen bee. I would say 95% of the beehive is worker bees, so it's mostly women. And the queen, while she technically is the leader of the hive, she's not always necessarily the one in control. She gives off a lot of pheromones and signals to help the hive, you know, manage its growth and all the other things that it does. And the boy bees really do nothing. They don't forage, they don't hunt, they don't guard. They're really only there for sex and morale.
Oh.
Yeah.
Sounds like some boys I know.
Well, when I was taking beekeeping classes, you know, the guy I was learning from was like, well, boys are just, you know, they just bring disease back to the hive. And all the ladies were like, mm-hmm.
So how do you help them? What do you do to help them?
Yeah, you know, I've been keeping bees for about 10 years. And I would say I feel like I'm less of a beekeeper and more of a caretaker. Because in the beginning, when I was learning, I thought my job was to control the bees. And really what I've learned is that I'm just following along and making sure that they have what they need to get to where they're going, which is honey making. And so my role as a caretaker is just to make sure that they're healthy and they have enough space, and, you know, to provide them with good spot to forage, and to just try and manage them in a positive way, and to help them get through their problems, which is the varroa mite, which is a terrible, it's like a bee tick, and it basically kills them.
Oh.
Yeah.
How did you decide one day to become a beekeeper? What's the history there?
So this is another funny story. So, you know, during all these trials and tribulations in my life, I got really stuck, like, creatively and emotionally. And one day I just woke up and I said, I want to jump out of an airplane right now. I want to get in a plane and I want to jump. I don't care if there's some guy on my back, 7,000 feet. I want to stare at the ground, because I had this moment where I was stuck and I just needed to, like, basically scare the crap out of myself, because I tried everything else, like how to overcome creative block and move through depression and all these other things. Some things worked, but I just felt like I needed a change, is looking back on it now. I know that I needed it then, but I wasn't sure how to communicate that. And I needed to scare myself. Of course, he said, no way. And I said, fine, so I'm going to do beekeeping. You know, because I...
Now, why beekeeping?
Well, I had made a mental list of all these things that seemed dangerous. And I just remember as a kid seeing all those photos of people covering themselves in bees. And I just thought, well, that looks equally as dangerous as jumping out of a plane.
And didn't you tell me that even when you wear that full suit, you can still get stung?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, it's a heavy cotton suit. But, you know, if the suit is pressed up against your skin and they sting you at the right angle, it will go right through the suit. Bees have an incredible sense of smell, and they can smell your fear and your anxiety and all that stuff. So, you know, one of the amazing things about beekeeping that I've learned and I love about it is, before I ever enter the bee yard and inspect a beehive, I have to have a pause. There's a moment where I just let it all go. I let go of my anxiety, my fear, all my troubles, all the things I feel about what's happening in this world today. Like, you have to let it go. And so beekeeping has become kind of this, like, meditative experience for me. And I don't like to really do it with other people. It's just me and the bees, and it's a quiet, calm moment, because that's how you have to interact with them, slowly, carefully, and it just helps me recenter myself. And I think that's the biggest part of it, of beekeeping. You know, so it's like I went out looking for danger, and really what I ended up finding was like a meditative sense of being.
You found serenity.
Yeah. In a lot of ways, yeah.
Yeah. So before you enter the area where the hives are, what do you call those boxes?
Well, there's the deeps where they live in, and then you have the supers where the honey is. But it's okay. Just called the Beehive.
The Beehive. Yeah. Okay. So before you enter the area where the beehives are, you kind of stand and just take a deep breath.
I do, yeah.
And you center and focus yourself.
Yep.
And then you walk in.
Yep. It's just it's not very long. It's just maybe a minute or two. And I take a couple deep breaths and just try and relax. Because my body can't be tense either. So it's just one of those moments. And usually I do it in the morning when the bees are a little calmer. And also there are moments too where sometimes I can tell that the bee yard, they're too rambunctious and I won't bother them, you know.
Oh, they're having a day.
Yeah, you can tell sometimes they're too excitable. And even if I remain calm, it's just, it doesn't work out sometimes.
Do they ever have any fights within the beehive? I mean, are there ever any, like, revolutions that go on?
No, I've never, ever seen a fight within a beehive. Now, if there's a weaker hive, sometimes another hive will try and take over. But that usually only happens when there's honey. It's called robbing. But it's usually only when one hive is weaker than another. But that doesn't happen very often.
And what about the smoking? What is that for?
Bees give off whenever you, like, open the hive, they will give off this pheromone that's like an attack pheromone because they're worried. And so the smoking blocks that pheromone. It also helps the bees move back down into the beehive, and so that when you take the lid off, they don't come boiling out and flying at you. So it does two things. It helps keep them calm. It masks the attack pheromone, which actually smells like bananas. I had somebody with me at a beehive 2 weeks ago, and she rolled up, and she was, like, eating a banana, and I was like, you have to sit in the car. You can't come over here. But, yeah, it's funny. Like, sometimes when I don't smoke enough, you can smell it. It smells like bananas. Yeah.
What happens to them in the winter?
So in the winter, they don't hibernate. That's a huge misconception. They are alive, and they are active. They get in a ball, and they start at the bottom of the beehive, and the queen is in the middle. And through body heat, they keep her in a pocket that's 98 degrees at all times. And they just do that through body movement. They go in to feed her and out to get the honey that they've stored. And then they just come back and they cycle. And slowly, this ball will move to the top of the beehive. So by February, they're in the top of the beehive in this ball.
But they only live 6 weeks, you said.
Yeah, this is the amazing thing. So in the summer, it's 6 weeks because they literally work themselves to death. In the winter, they can last up to 4 months simply because they're not working.
I mean,
that just tells you how busy they are. I mean, this phrase of busy bees, it's totally true.
Now, if you go someday to the hive and you find mites, what is it that you do?
So mites, varroa mite, it's like a bee tick, and it gets on the larva of the bee and it stays on the bee even as an adult, as it evolves, until it basically kills it. It basically, like, sucks the blood out of the bee. The mites are always there. Some people check for mites. There's different ways you can do it. Alcohol wash, powdered sugar, other things like that. I honestly don't even check because they're there. Everyone has mites. But there are different treatments you can do. Some more natural, some not. But yeah, I treat them twice a year for mites, and that kills the mites, brings them to a more livable level for the bees. But they're always there. It's usually what kills the bees in the wintertime is the mites just take over when they're the most vulnerable.
Have you ever had a whole hive go down?
Oh, yeah. I've had years where I've lost all my beehives.
Oh.
Yeah. Last year, I had 50% survived, and I feel really lucky because the year before that, it was 30%. It's not uncommon for beekeepers to lose all their hives year after year. Problems with bees, it's real.
You know, I'm so struck when I'm speaking with you about how you kind of found your way back to nature.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you went to school for art and design, and you had a successful business. You moved to New York City. You're living in the Matagogo world of New York City. And then you found a place up here in, I think you said it was 2005.
Yep.
And you're actually living here full time now.
Yeah, we just gave up our apartment officially last week.
Yeah. And it's something about the bees are such an integral part of nature. And I think you said when I talked to you earlier that wouldn't it be something if everyone was a beekeeper? You know, the world would be very different.
Well, I think if we all follow the way the bees are, you know, where we all can work together towards common goals. I mean, it sounds so idealistic and ridiculous in this current world that we live in, but it's true. And I think the bees have totally changed my life in a way that sometimes I'm not even really sure what it means or where it's taking me, But I'm grateful that I found beekeeping because it really has changed not only my life, but it's influenced the way I make artwork and the way I live, and it's helped me sort out and discover new goals that I think are more obtainable, you know.
Sounds like your priorities are different too.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think everyone moves to New York City for big hopes and dreams. And I will say we lived there 18 years. We did great things. I had great experiences. I got a lot out of it for my career. I have zero regrets. But I think at the same time, the longer we were there, the more I just wanted to find something else. And for a while there, it was fun to have best of both worlds, you know, city and country life. It sounds so bourgeois, but it's awesome. But then at some point, I just felt like the city changed, and or maybe it was me, and I didn't want it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted something better. And I don't want to say simpler, or like I wasn't, like I didn't want to work as much, but I work just as much. But I just feel more centered out here.
Yeah.
You know?
So if you could just say one thing that you think the bees have taught you, that's the most important thing, what would you say it was?
Well, I would say the one thing would be sometimes to just let it go and follow the path that's given to you. And you may not know what that is, but I think just keep going and don't stop. Because I would say that's the one major thing that I love about the bees is they don't stop. Even when they know that they're going to die in 6 weeks, they do not stop.
You think they know they're going to die in 6 weeks?
Oh, I don't know if they know that, but...
You know.
Yeah, I know. But they don't stop. And they do it all for the greater good.
Mm.
And I think that is a beautiful concept, you know?
Yeah, because probably when you were in New York, you were more focused on yourself, getting to be known as a great graphic designer or what have you. But here, you're giving.
Yeah. Well, I think it's always good to pay attention to yourself and have goals for yourself.
Sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just, sometimes I feel like I don't know, it's so rewarding to give more of yourself for somebody else, you know.
I think that's a perfect place to end. And
oh,
I want
to
thank you so much, Charles. I really enjoyed talking
to
you.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You have been listening to Catskill Character on WJFF Radio Catskill. My guest today has been Charles Wilkin, artist and beekeeper. Charles' website is charleswilkin.com, or you can Google Two Queens Honey for links to the bees. Catskill Character is on every Saturday morning right after Farm and Country. I'm Donna Fellenberg. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Radio Catskill is partnering with StoryCorps for One Small Step, matching strangers with different political beliefs to just have a conversation about their lives. Hi, I'm Judy Balaban, and I'm working on One Small Step at Radio Catskill. Help bring our community together, one conversation at a time. Go to WJFFradio.org and click on the One Small Step logo to join us.
StoryCorps' One Small Step and the radio station hubs are made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Hello, Graham Rice of the Waggaload of Monkeys here with news about your favorite folk music shows on Sunday afternoons here on Radio Catskill. Folk Plus, our long-running thematic mix of contemporary folk music with Angela Page, is moving to 2 p.m., the hour before my show. And the best of Irish and British folk music on the Waggaload of Monkeys follows at 3. It's a new year and a slightly new schedule, starting January the 5th here on Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill is partnering with StoryCorps for One Small Step, pairing up strangers to have conversations, not debates. Remind the country of the humanity in all of us. Sign up at wjffradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville. You're listening to Radio Catskill.